warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor. Two arch enemies battle to the death. Thor, the thunder god, against a staggering beast. A giant snake who strikes with lethal force. It is man versus monster. Thor unleashes his deadliest weapon, lightning from his magic hammer, as thunder rocks heaven and earth. The myth of Thor is filled with these epic showdowns, heroic battles against creatures who threaten mankind.
Thor is the champion of the gods. He's the great fighter who can be brought out when something is really bad. You don't go to Thor for wisdom. Go to Thor because he's going to protect you against the evil monsters.
Tales of Thor's adventures provided escape from one of the bleakest periods in human history, the Dark Ages of the first millennium AD. It was a time when the Norse world, stretching from the British Isles to the Baltic Sea, was in turmoil.
It's an agricultural society where people were farming and surviving kind of at the very edge of how it was possible to survive because it was cold. It was the northern part of Europe. It wasn't around the Mediterranean where it was much easier to grow things. And it tended to be, from everything we can tell, quite violent.
War, famine and death were daily facts of life on the desolate northern fringes of Europe. But the myth of Thor brought a sense of order to the chaos.
It was a religion of the countryside. Paganism actually is a Latin word that describes that, what the country people believe in. And paganism is not really well organized either. It's not like the Greek pantheon in the sense that it's very well organized and everybody knows whose responsibilities and who's more important than whom. It's very different.
The view of human life in that mythology was a fairly dark, a fairly stern one. Human beings didn't look forward to the kind of salvation in heaven at the end of time that's promised in the Christian stories. They had a kind of a darker, a more sorrowful view of life. People have to show great courage and hardiness in the face of enormous obstacles.
For inspiration, the people looked to Thor.
I sure would rather revere Thor than that mythical Jew on a stick representing failure. And this is Terrible Tommy in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And it is the 12th of November 2015, and it is a rainy, blustery, high wind day here in the Midwest. Boy, I woke up to really big winds everywhere from 25 to almost 50 miles an hour. But it's calmed down a little now, but we still got a lot of wind. So that's show business here in the Midwest. Incidentally, I'm wanting to a lot of these war surplus news items I've been sending out, I think we would be best to put them on the internet, on the website. And so I'm wanting to set up a breaking news, and I think we've got a breaking news up there. I haven't looked lately. Column, and then maybe a little flashing sign on the front of the system to say breaking news and where to go. And I'll put all the late breaking news and so forth and comment up there. We want to try that out, and then that way I don't need to send you each individual, that type of thing. And if you're interested in breaking news, you can go up there, and if you're not interested, you don't have to get it. So that's the way I'm looking at things. What do you think? How about that? I sent you a little ad today about an electronic sign that I'm wanting to put up out in front to replace the war sign that the local Pharisees and Sadducees decided to make me take down. But I'm wanting to put up this sign, which I can control by computer. And if they try to make me take that one down, they're not going to. It's not going to go down. If I have to go to jail, I'll go to jail. So if you want to get in on the act, any extra donations you might want to send, I'd appreciate it for that. I'm trying to figure out where they're coming from. They want over $100 to ship it. Now, I don't know whether they're coming from overseas or what, but if I could find out if they're shipping here inside the country, maybe we could figure a way of getting rid of that big amount of shipping charge. Well, let's go back to our pessimist guide of history, to history. And this was AD 1490. Syphilis epidemic begins. Whoa! The origin of the sudden virulent epidemic of syphilis, which broke out in Europe in the 1490s, is unknown. The disease first appeared in Italy, and by 1495 was reported in France, Germany, Switzerland, Holland, and Greece. By 1497, it had appeared in England and Scotland, and 2 years later was reported in Hungary and Russia. As usual, foreigners were blamed for spreading the disease, especially those who were disliked. The Russians blamed the Poles. The English and the Turks called it a French disease. The French termed it an Italian illness, and they in turn referred to it as a Spanish disease. The Spanish called it the sickness of Hispaniola, declaring it had come from what is now Haiti and was brought back by the Columbus crew. Now, that's the one I would most likely believe. Medical historians now think that syphilis had been in Europe for years, and that what Columbus's crew brought back was a new strain to which the Europeans were not immune. So that was nigger syphilis. In any case, syphilis did not discriminate. People from all walks of life and all classes were infected. Doctors were mystified by the horrible disease, marked by pustules and skin eruptions, leg ulcers, and finally madness. Treatments were unusual and extreme. Boiled vulture broth from sarsaparilla, or serpent's blood. One army doctor claimed to have amputated the genitalia of 5,000 infected soldiers. The disease raged on for much of the next century until immunity began to develop and the severity of the epidemic abated. So if you think you got it tough now, baby, you get that new strain of nigger syphilis and you were in trouble. AD 1502, hurricane destroys the Spanish treasure fleet. A fleet of 30 Spanish ships left the port and colony of Santo Domingo in the modern Dominican Republic in early July, despite the warnings of Christopher Columbus, who was in the port and saw signs of a hurricane brewing. It's coming, boys. It's coming. The ships, loaded down with precious cargoes of gold and other valuables, were only a day and a half out to sea when they sailed straight into a fierce hurricane. The small, heavily loaded wooden caravels were no match for the furious winds and pounding waves. Some sank on the high seas, while others were blown far off course and battered on the reefs and the coast of Santo Domingo. All but four ships sank and or were wrecked, and 500 of the officers and crew members were killed. Among the treasures spilled into the sea was a gold nugget reputed to be the size of a dinner plate. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky in morning, sailor take warning. Well, much of that treasure is still out there, and once in a while somebody finds a hunk of it. But it's still out there, and it's a testament to man's greed, really. He'd do anything for greed. Early capitalism, all that risk and danger, so the ruling class could wear their trinkets around their necks, and the females of the monarchs could wear these gems and so forth.
Following up on Beulah's comments there, you have to look at the source of the issue here. We're hearing he and Holland on both sides. This is an experiment on desegregation. We're seeing what happens when blacks and whites are forced to mix. What I propose is to have separate universities. So that way these blacks, so-called African-Americans, which are black, they're black and brown, have the separate university. That way they won't have to put up with the white people. Here, it's an attempt to raise the black nation up, an infant race that stomps their feet to get what they want, anytime they get what they want. Now they've got a white guy fired for no reason. I hope he finds another job. And another comment, I feel sorry for the white students at the college. I wouldn't want to have to attend school with these type of people. I would say come to Princeton. Come to Ivy League. It's a lot better. Thanks.
Well, that was our own stray dog back east, and good job. But I'm sorry for the technical difficulties there, but there's some interaction in trying to play that one back. So anyhow, I've got to... I did the best I could on that, so you got it. Well, Apple is kissing the ass of the blacks this morning, or this afternoon. This was on the BBC. Apple has apologized to six schoolboy Negroes asked to leave one of their shops in Australia in what the students described as a racist incident. Well, of course, they were screwing around, probably damaging material in the shop, and so they got their ass kicked out. So it's all over the place. Every time, see, it's on Washington Post. It came out at Deutsche Welle, Germany. It came, ABC News picked it up. Any little thing that happens to a niglet is worldwide news. And so they're going to get worse and worse and worse. When you let a child stamp its feet, scream, and roll around in the aisles of the store, and you don't do anything, you don't kick its ass or spank it, it's going to get worse. And so, worse is better. Let the niggers go crazy. Only after a certain point will people take it directly in hand and solve the problem. All the bitching that the blacks do doesn't, and all the press and attention and everybody's crying crocodile tears over them does not help them. It makes them weaker. And they don't seem to understand that, or maybe even care. But the more they stamp their feet and cry, and Whitey comes to their aid and sympathizes and cries with them and gives them money and all kinds of things, the worse situation the blacks will be in. Now you've got educators all over the country, in all the schools and everything, saying, oh, we got to have a task force. We've got to do something about this. This is horrible. Now, if you remember, the reports in this case in Missouri was that somebody yelled out a window of a pickup truck something racial, and somebody painted a swastika with a felt pen someplace on the campus. That's all it took. Now, we have no idea. We don't have any idea who did that, but it could very well have been black. If I were the blacks, I would go around doing that everywhere. And pretty soon they'd get everything they want. They put a black radical in charge of the university. Why not? Come on, Whitey, give them all the fucking shit they want. And watch them get weaker and weaker and weaker. I see over 1,000 Ithaca College students walked out to protest racism. It reminds me of the Red Scare back in the 50s and 60s. Students participating in a die-in on campus sidewalks at the Solidarity Walkout November 11th. The die-in stretched from the campus center to the... I lost that. But anyhow, they everywhere. And then you see WHAM TV picked it up. NBC News picked it up. Gazette Net picked it up, and literally dozens and dozens of news media pick it up and cater to these black bastards. I clear up in Lincoln, Nebraska. Daniel Young was riding a UNL dormitory elevator last year when she was called the N-word for the first time, and she was so shocked she pissed her pants. Quote, I was trying to get my iPod to turn on, but I couldn't figure out how to do it, and I couldn't get any white people to help me, but it was taking a long time, said Young, a University of Nebraska Lincoln sophomore from Omaha who was riding the three white students. Quote, they didn't realize my music wasn't playing, and one of them goes, dude, is that a nigger? UNL junior Gloria Kambula was walking from campus to downtown movie theater when a drunk student stepped into a fraternity house porch to tell the black passerbys they weren't welcome at the party, while the white students ahead of them were. Oh, poor black people, we don't get a chance, man. The student used the racial slur, I guess was nigger, to get his point across, said Kambula, who was born to Congolese parents in Spain before moving to Lincoln, Nebraska to fuck up the white race. Quote, I didn't report it. We just kind of brushed it aside, Kambula said. My friends and I just knew that was something we were going to happen at some point in our lives. There's white people come from everywhere. They all called us nigga. I think the churches in Lincoln, Nebraska are taking up a big collection to give these Negroes that heard this terrible slur a big payoff, man, because they deserve it. You know, they deserve it. Kambula said she believes that racism on Yik Yak goes beyond a few bad apples and exemplifies a systematic problem only furthered by social media. Oh, we got to cut off social media. She said racism at UNL, the university, is not just directed at black students, but also Asian and international students as well. You ever wonder why you don't hear the Asians bitching about this? You hardly ever hear an Asian griping because somebody called them a name. They just go on about their stuff. The Negroes, man, they got to tell somebody, man. Next week, Young and Kambula plan to use social media to fight back by starting a conversation about racism both on campus and in apps students download to their telephone. We're going to get rid of racism. You're never going to get rid of racism, you idiots. Now, the famous but incompetent are jumping into it with the FBI hate crime statistics. Approximately 6,000 hate crimes motivated by gender, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, or disability reported to the FBI in 2013. That's nothing spread out over that many sections. That is nothing, because they class anything, you know, felt pen marks KKK on a wall or anything, that's a hate crime. So probably 5,999 of those were nothing. I mean, you know, the famous but incompetent. They're going to stop it, though. They're going to set up some more white people and send them to jail for 100 years. And in Seattle, can Seattle wipe out racism in juvenile justice? Well, not as long as Negro kids do far more damage and commit far more crimes than the white population. They got a grassroots plan to make it happen, though. There you go. Good luck, buddies. Well, this crying about racism by the white people just goes on and on the internet for pages and pages and pages. And actually, it's very good, I think, because when you scream and yell about something and not too much, it's called overcompensation, and people get tired of hearing it. They just turn off. In the advertising business, there's been books written about this, that if you run ads too repetitive, too long, people just start turning them off. And just like they do these, a lot of these over-the-counter or drugs that you're advertising on TV, very expensive ads, well, they keep hammering away and people just start turning them off. Same way with racism, so they can scream all they want, and that's good, till most white people just turn it off, no matter what they say in public. If you ask them, oh, I hate racism, I don't like racism, and all that bullshit, the hypocrites. Boy, we got a lot of chicken shit defense attorneys over there in Germany, and we probably got a lot of them here too. But I see they're going all on and on about this neo-Nazi trial over in Germany. These attorneys are asking to resign ahead of the client's testimony, because you know the client's testimony is you're going to give a speech, and they just can't stand the fact that they'll be standing defending a guy who will defend the white race and the Aryan race, and he is a neo-Nazi. So they want out of it because they don't want their name to be smirched. Well, here's a false flag. I'm convinced it's false flag now, after all this time. Plans by a so-called neo-Nazi to turn two South Central Nebraska towns into all-white hamlets ran off the rails last week after residents joined forces to sabotage the effort. Well, number one, most of those little towns are all-white anyhow, you know, so they got one token black to shine shoes or something, you know. So to go in there and make a big deal and stick a stick into the beehive, get all these locals all excited, give them a reason for living, to fight racism, is stupid, and it's a false flag. Craig Cobb, I'm convinced, is a false flagger. Either that or he's nuts. And VNN is nuts for supporting him and pushing it. Craig Cobb had purchased property in the towns of Red Cloud and Innavale and Webster County Sheriff's sale in September, and also inquired about property in two nearby north central Kansas towns. Now, you see, like I've advocated for decades for young people, especially if they've got a trade, to move into small outlying towns and just become regular citizens of the community. Don't yell and scream about their racial views and just burrow in. And they can do a lot more good that way than this waving the flag coming to town. It says here the action was part of an effort called Pioneer Little Europe, a strategy to create communities where white nationalists live in close proximity to business that offer cultural facilities and services. Well, look at me. Everybody knows who I am, but I didn't come to town with a brass band, and I'm accepted around here by most of the people. I get along with them. I don't beat them over the head with the racial cause, but most of them know who I am, and a lot of them like it. But if I had to come to town flying a swastika flag on top of my house and all that kind of stuff, and having Klan rallies in my backyard, I know what would have happened. So Craig Cobb is not a stupid man. He's an intelligent man, and that's why I don't leave him off the hook. And I don't leave these people at VNN off the hook who support him, just like they did Glenn Pecker. You know, they had to know how nuts he was, but yet they kept on supporting him. That's more than just error. That's false flag, and they could take it to the bank too, because that's what I'm saying and that's what I'm standing by. This is a method of muddying the water badly, to where any new person, any new white family moving into these small towns is going to be suspect. That's what they're doing, and it's smart. It's smart as hell, while parading as being the savior of white people, they're actually destroying the ability to save white people. This is another way these people can block legitimate people from coming into town if they don't like their the way they cut their hair. Under Nebraska law, the sales had to be confirmed by a judge before they became final. You see, that's a typical Jewish type thing, to keep some people out of the community. But last week, the foreclosure case was dismissed and the properties were turned back to persons with a legal interest in them. With assistance from the community, they came up with the funds to pay the back taxes. Residents in the communities were thrilled at the turn of events. "We're done with him for the time being," said Red Cloud Mayor Gary Retzlaff. "Now we can step back and take a breath." Well, if people follow my advice, he's not going to take another breath, because we can figure other ways, even though these Craig Cobb and the boys at VNN and people like that have muddied the water badly, but there's methods of getting around this. But this is a stupidity or design of the right wing. I believe most of the right wing racial struggle is a false flag. I think it's been that way for years, and the longer I look at it and how they operate, the more I believe that. Now, this story comes mostly out of Iceland, and it's more right wing stuff. The Mojave colored pills cause a state of aggressive delirium, and cops are struggling to cope with the sudden outbreaks of violence they cause. Scores of teenagers and students have been rushed to the hospital after frequently collapsing and foaming at the mouth after taking the hallucinogenic drug. They're selling as cheap as 12 pounds on the black market and are extremely popular in Iceland at the moment. The pills are so strong, police are being told not to handle them without gloves. A young man recently went off his head on the substance and attacked a neighbor for no reason before he foamed at the mouth and collapsed. Icelandic police commissioner Haraldur Johansson said that the tablet causes strong hallucinogenic effects, and we have numerous cases of users who have completely lost touch with reality or endangered themselves and others. Okay. It happens as a bizarre clog-wearing Hitler cult is on the rise in rural Germany. Now, I have no proof of that at all. The neo-Nazis, who call themselves nationalist settlers, are trying to take over small villages and work on farms. Now, here again, that's that Cobb syndrome, where they make a big deal, go into town and say they're going to take over, but they don't move into this society and settle down and open up shops and so forth. Researcher Ann Schmidt says that this is a very scary movement to observe. These extremely nationalist right-wing people are settling specifically in little populated areas far away from the cities to live and raise their children in a backward ideology, unquote. Rock star Nick Cave's son fell to his death from cliffs after taking LSD. An inquest heard this week. Well, wait a minute here.
First line of defense for my patients with sensitive teeth.
If you want to understand the brain, you have to understand why the brain changes under the influence of psychedelics. LSD, I would argue, is one of the most important drugs that's ever been studied.
Science doesn't yet know how LSD works in the brain.
LSD.
And LSD is one of the most potent drugs that there is. It's also one of the most interesting, perhaps the most interesting, because of the way it alters consciousness.
What's more important than consciousness? It affects everyone. Consciousness is the center of everyone's life. What can be more interesting than understanding better how we are the way we are?
Psychedelics have been part of human history. Every culture that's been discovered has used psychedelics. This project is, I think, one of the most significant projects in the history of brain research. It's been banned effectively from research for 50 years. That's outrageous. That's the worst censorship of science has ever been. And I want to rectify that. Now we're going to do the first ever human imaging study with LSD.
We're in a privileged, very privileged position, because we know that we're going to find something. We don't quite know what, but we know it's going to be meaningful. So what we do is recruit some volunteers for the study, which usually isn't very hard. They are administered LSD intravenously in the morning. And essentially what we're doing is we're using two different brain imaging modalities to ask different questions, but complementary questions, about how LSD works in the brain.
Brain imaging is almost like a new art form because you can relate what you're experiencing to what's actually happening in there, and that gives a whole new tool to explore and understand how consciousness works better.
One of the nicest feelings is coming home, you know, with the knowledge that they've had profound experiences under LSD and that we've captured what was happening in their brains when they were having those profound experiences. And that gives me a very deep sense of satisfaction and excitement, really, about what we're going to find when we do the analyses.
The study of psychedelics can really address two fundamental questions. The first is how the brain works, and the second is, can we use the alterations in brain function to medical benefit? Can we help people with disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder, like depression, get better? People get locked into a mindset of depressive thinking because they cannot disengage from that mindset. And psychedelics seem to disrupt the parts of the brain which force that thinking and allow people to think differently.
We're working in an area which is set to be the next big thing in psychology and psychiatry, potentially. I really do believe that. And I also do believe in the therapeutic potential of these drugs, that they could be useful for helping people understand themselves, helping them understand of whatever is troubling them.
Well, the basis of the idea seems good, but when the false flag Svengalis and possibly Jews get involved, they're misleading these people, and so they're infecting this right-wing, supposedly racial bunch over there in Germany and Europe with these dangerous drugs. And that's another reason I'm saying that the right wing internationally, racially, is being subverted and guided in the wrong direction. And it has become a major false flag operation, which the very people who are creating the problems are the ones in the press then standing back and talking about how horrible it is that these neo-Nazis are spreading and using all these psychedelic drugs. So you got to be smart or you're going to go down. That's all I can say. Well, as far as I'm concerned, here's another false flag operation. I was waiting for it to come out. To no one's surprise, America's most popular neo-Nazi website, Daily Stormer, has officially announced its support for Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. Predictably, the endorsement praised the numerous racist statements in Trump's announcement video, especially his willingness to call Mexicans out as criminal rapists, murderers, and drug dealers. The typical xenophobic right-wing jargon about China and Mexico stealing our jobs also featured prominently in the endorsement, as Trump has emphasized this theme heavily. In reality, of course, invaders have lower rates of crime. Well, we won't go into that because, see the problem, they always hand you part truth, these false flaggers. Obviously, some of the things that Trump says we agree with, but as a presidential candidate, it's a waste of time. It is a waste of time. Now, here's the thing that they're not taking into consideration. He totally supports the military-industrial complex and the giant expansion of the weapons program and so forth. Right there is enough to kill him as far as any candidate that I would ever support. And so anyhow, I've had suspicions of this Daily Stormer for some time. I think whoever's behind it, and I see no real name ever with it, is playing either making a stupid mistake, or if he was supporting Donald Trump, why not keep your mouth shut? Because it's not going to help Donald Trump. And, of course, if this Daily Stormer is just trying to use this as to hurt him, that's not the way to pay politics either. So anyhow, more false flag crap in the right wing. Here's another bullshit program that sort of a false flag operation, mostly out of stupidity. The KKK keeps wanting to adopt a highway around the country. That started with this numbskull Tom Robb out in Arkansas, I believe. They want to adopt a highway so they can clean up the garbage left beside the road by the niggers, the spicks, and any other lowlife, whites included. What an honor to have a sign put on the side of the highway. This garbage along this road is picked up by loyal members of the working class Klan, and now they're doing it, trying to do it in Georgia. And of course the courts will say, oh yeah, that's okay, let them clean up the garbage. We wouldn't want to interfere with them cleaning up nigger shit filled diapers and things like that. The glorious KKK false flag, you decide. All the Hollywood Klan has to do now is on this Missouri and all this stuff and these universities going crazy about racism, is put out the press release that dozens of carloads of Klansmen are converging on the university for a impromptu demonstration. And these people would go absolutely nuts. They'd be stampeding each other. They'd physically run over the FBI agents trying to solve the situation. I love it. It's funny. Here's a whole bunch of more news on the KKK. Police are looking for the person responsible for leaving KKK flyers at a home on School Street in Hampton. And I'm not sure where Hampton's at, but they say whoever left the KKK flyers could be charged with littering. These kind of articles are going around the world. I mean, this is crazy. It's funny. All the Hollywood Klan has to do is just throw a bunch of papers out the window or just little decals or anything, and the whole town, the city, they all go nuts. I'm telling you, people in other countries must think we're totally insane. Now, that piece of news is all over the place in this paper. I'm not sure where it comes from. But then in a little teeny paper, look at this. There's a great big, or very little ad, actually, talking about a man who's been shot 3 times on the street. But a couple of papers thrown out of a car by the KKK gets round the world news, where the poor guy gets shot on the street, gets almost none. And most likely, if I were gambling, I'd say it was a nigger who shot him, and probably the guy who got shot was a nigger. Well, I see that Glenn Miller, the great warrior of the white race, got a death penalty for getting drunk and murdering 3 people who he thought were Jews. And I guess he's got the complete support of VNN and other. I'm not going to even go into it, because if you don't understand what's going on, I don't know how I can explain it to you. This is why the right wing never gets any place, or the racial part of the right wing never gets any place. They support people like this numbskull, who they know is a moron, an alcoholic, and had been married to an Asian with an Asian, half-Asian kid and the whole bit, but was welcomed 100% into the Klan and the VNN operation. So, I mean, with a crazy-ass movement like that, they're never going to go anyplace. And they're going to, you wait and see, they're going to drum up Glenn Miller as a big hero of the white race. You wait and see.
Listen to this. When never life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough. Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned, a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. It can whiz as fast as it can go, the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
Feels so sort of insignificant, doesn't it?
Yeah. Can we have your liver then?
I just had to play that. The insanity of all this crap we have to go through and read about and all this bullshit. Enough to drive you crazy. Enough to drive you absolutely round the bend. But we'll persevere. What was that one? Oh, yeah. That was from that movie, Outlaw Josie Wales, when Josie Wales met up with the Indian, and the Indian said, we went to Washington to talk to the Great White Father, and the Great White Father answered to our demands, persevere to persevere. And he said, well, then what happened? Well, we went back again and talked to the Great White Father to get a break. And he said, persevere to persevere. And we went back home. Well, then what did you do? We declared war on the government.
Chapter 1 of In the Days of Giants. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Arup Sen. In the Days of Giants, by Abby Farwell Brown. The Beginning of Things. The oldest stories of every race of people tell about the beginning of things, but the various folk who first told them were so different, the tales are so very old, and have changed so greatly in the telling from one generation to another, that there are almost as many accounts of the way in which the world began as there are nations upon the earth. So it is not strange that the people of the north have a legend of the beginning quite different from that of the southern, eastern, and western folk. This book is made of the stories told by the northern folk, the people who live in the land of the midnight sun, where summer is green and pleasant, but winter is a terrible time of cold and gloom, where rocky mountains tower like huge giants, over whose heads the thunder rolls and crashes, and under whose feet are mines of precious metals, Therefore, you will find the tales full of giants and dwarfs, spirits of the cold mountains and dark caverns. You will find the hero to be Thor, with his thunderbolt hammer, who dwells in the happy heaven of Asgard, where Allfather Odin is king, and where Balder the Beautiful makes springtime with his smile. In the North countries, winter, cold, and frost are very real and terrible enemies, while spring, sunshine, and warmth are near and dear friends. So the story of the beginning of things is a story of cold and heat, of the wicked giants who loved the cold, and of the good Aesir who baked in pleasant warmth. In the very beginning of things, the stories say, there were two worlds, one of the burning heat and one of icy cold. The cold world was in the north, and from it flowed Elivagar, a river of poisonous water which hardened into ice and piled up into great mountains, filling the space which had no bottom. The other world in the south was on fire with bright flame, a place of heat most terrible. And in those days, through all space, there was nothing beside these two worlds of heat and cold. But then began a fierce combat. Heat and cold met and strove to destroy each other, as they have tried to do ever since. Flaming sparks from the hot world fell upon the ice river, which flowed from the place of cold. And though the bright sparks were quenched, in dying they wrought mischief, as they do today. For they melted the ice, which dripped and dripped like tears from the suffering world of cold. And then, wonderful to say, these chilly drops became alive, became a huge breathing mass, a frost giant, with a wicked heart of ice. And he was the ancestor of all the giants who came afterwards, a bad and cruel race. At that time, there was no earth, nor sea, nor heaven, nothing but the icy abyss without bottom, whence Ymir the giant had sprung. And there he lived, nourished by the milk of a cow which the heat had formed. Now the cow had nothing for her food but the snow and ice of Elivagar, and that was cold victuals indeed. One day she was licking the icy rocks, which tasted salty to her, when Ymir noticed that the mass was taking a strange shape. The more the cow licked it, the plainer became the outline of the shape. And when evening came, Ymir saw thrusting itself through the icy rock a head of hair. The next day the cow went on with her meal, and at night time a man's head appeared above the rock. On the third day the cow licked away the ice, until forth stepped a man, tall and powerful and handsome. This was no evil giant, for he was good. And strangely, though he came from the ice, his heart was warm. He was the ancestor of the kind Aesir. For Allfather Odin and his brothers, Vili and Ve, the first of the gods, were his grandsons. And as soon as they were born, they became the enemies of the race of the giants. Now, after a few giant years, ages and ages of time as we reckon it, there was a great battle, for Odin and his brothers wished to destroy all the evil in the world and to leave only good. They attacked the wicked giant Ymir. First of all his race, and after hard fighting, slew him. Ymir was so huge that when he died, a mighty river of blood flowed from the wounds which Odin had given him. A stream so large that it flooded all space, and the frost giants, his children and grandchildren, were drowned, except one who escaped with his wife in a chest. And but for the saving of these two, that would have been the end of the race of giants. All Father and his brothers now had work to do. Painfully they dragged the great bulk of Ymir into the bottomless space of ice. And from it they built the earth, the sea, and the heavens. Not an atom of his body went to waste. His blood made the great ocean, the rivers, the lakes, and the springs. His mighty bones became mountains. His teeth and broken bones made sand and pebbles. From his skull they fashioned the arching heaven, which they set up over the earth and sea. His brain became the heavy clouds. His hair sprouted into trees, grass, plants, and flowers. And last of all, the Aesir set his bristling eyebrows as a high fence around the earth, to keep the giants away from the race of men whom they had planned to create for this pleasant globe. So the earth was made, and next the gods brought light for the heavens. They caught the sparks and cinders blown from the world of heat, and set them here and there, above and below, as sun and moon and stars. To each they gave its name and told what its duties were to be, and how it must perform them, day after day, and year after year, and century after century, to the ending of all things, so that the children of men might reckon time without mistake. Sol and Mani, who drove the bright chariots of the sun and moon across the sky, were a fair sister and brother whose father named them sun and moon because they were so beautiful. So Odin gave them each a pair of swift, bright horses to drive, and set them in the sky forever. Once upon a time, but that was many, many years later, Mani, the man in the moon, stole two children from the earth. Hiyuki and Bil were going to a well to draw a pail of water. The little boy and girl carried a pole and a bucket across their shoulders, and looked so pretty that Mani thrust down a long arm and snatched them up to his moon. And there they are to this day, as you can see on any moonlight night. Two little black shadows on the moon's bright face, the boy and the girl, with the bucket between them. The gods also made day and night. Day was fair, bright, and beautiful, for he was of the warm-hearted Aesir race. But night was dark and gloomy, because she was one of the cold giant folk. Day and night had each a chariot drawn by a swift horse, and each in turn drove about the world in a 24-hour journey. Night rode first behind her dark horse, Hrimfaxi, who scattered dew from its bit upon the sleeping earth. After her came Day, with its beautiful horse, Glad, whose shining mane shot rays of light through the sky. All these wonders the kind gods wrought, that they might make a pleasant world for men to call their home. And now the gods, or Aesir as they were called, must choose a place for their own dwelling. For there were many of them, a glorious family. Outside of everything, beyond the great ocean which surrounded the world, was Jotunheim, the cold country where the giants lived. The green earth was made for men. The gods therefore decided to build their city above men in the heavens, where they could watch the doings of their favorites and protect them from the wicked giants. Asgard was to be their city, and from Asgard to Midgard, the home of men, stretched a wonderful bridge, a bridge of many colors. For it was the rainbow that we know and love. Up and down the rainbow bridge the Aesir could travel to the earth, and thus keep close to the doings of men. Next, from the remnants of Ymir's body, the gods made the race of little dwarfs, a wise folk and skillful, but in nature more like the giants than the good Aesir, for they were spiteful and often wicked, and they loved the dark and the cold better than the light and warmth. They lived deep down below the ground in caves and rocky dens, and it was their business to dig the precious metals and glittering gems that were hidden in the rocks, and to make wonderful things from the treasures of the underworld. Poof, poof, went their little bellows. Tink-tank went their hammers on the little anvils all day and all night. Sometimes they were friendly to the giants, and sometimes they did kindly deeds for the Aesir. But always after men came upon the earth, they hated these new folk who eagerly sought for the gold and the jewels which the dwarves kept hidden in the ground. The dwarfs lost no chance of doing evil to the race of men. Now the gods were ready for the making of men. They longed to have a race of creatures whom they could love and protect and bless with all kinds of pleasures. So Odin, with his brothers Hænir and Loki, crossed the rainbow bridge and came down to the earth. They were walking along the seashore when they found two trees, an ash and an elm. These would do as well as anything for their purpose. Odin took the two trees and warmly breathed upon them, and lo, they were alive, a man and a woman. Hænir then gently touched their foreheads, and they became wise. Lastly, Loki softly stroked their faces. Their skin grew pink with ruddy color, and they received the gifts of speech, hearing, and sight. Ask and Embla were their names, and the ash and the elm became the father and mother of the whole human race, whose dwelling was Midgard, under the eyes of the Aesir who had made them. This is the story of the beginning of things.
And there's the first chapter in a very interesting book, and these are on audiobooks. That one's in the Day of the Giants, Thor and Norse Mythology. And let me see here. You can pick them up on the internet, no problem, under greatestaudiobooks.com. That's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day. That's true, Freya's Day. 14-5. And watch out for those false flags. They're cropping up everywhere.